10. Back up north. New theaters. In 1975, the Cold War underwent some geographic shifts. Washington abandoned some of the regions where it had made constant war on communism, while the anti-communist regimes it had helped create continued to scorch the earth all around them. The United States left South Vietnam. In the Western world, this meant that Saigon fell. From the perspective of Hanoi, the Vietnamese had only achieved what they should have gotten through the referendum that Washington had helped cancel back in 1956. 3 million had died, the entire nation was militarized, and huge swaths of the country's lush jungles were rendered poisonous for generations because of U.S. chemical warfare. After the fall of Saigon, there was no communist-led mass murder of civilians in Vietnam. The massacres came in Cambodia. In 1970, the United States had orchestrated a coup to oust Prince Sihanouk and installed Lan Nol, a general who was supposed to be Cambodia's Suharto. His forces trained in Bandung, not far from the site of Sukarno's 1955 Afro-Asian Conference. During Lan Nol's rule, the United States continued to bomb the country indiscriminately, killing hundreds of thousands of people, mostly peasants, in a futile attempt to stop Vietnamese communists from moving through the countryside. The United States dropped 3 times the tonnage on Cambodia that fell on Japan during World War II, atom bombs included. For the people who survived, the effect of the B-52s on those nearby was reminiscent of the sulfatos in Guatemala. The terror was complete. One lost control of bodily functions as the mind screamed incomprehensible orders to get out, one Vietnamese official remembered later. The disregard for life was staggering and well understood in Southeast Asia. Traumatized refugees flooded Cambodia's cities. After the U.S.-backed coup that deposed him, the ousted Prince Sihanouk published a book of memoirs titled My War with the CIA. "We refused to become U.S. puppets or join in the anti-communist crusade," he wrote. "That was our crime." He threw his support behind the small, shadowy, and strange group of Marxists he had repressed while in power. The Khmer Rouge, as he called them in the old colonial language, were the only ones fighting against Lan Nol and the U.S. Army, which was wiping out entire swaths of the population. In 1975, the Red Khmer took Phnom Penh back from Lan Nol without Vietnamese assistance. They closed the borders and set up one of the most horrifying regimes of the 20th century. It would be years before anyone, even their supposed allies in Hanoi, knew what they were doing. In 1975, Magdalena and Sukarno were still in prison. They were still surviving on starvation rations and forced to endure backbreaking work in Indonesia's system of concentration camps. For 10 years, it had been drilled into them that they were evil, outcast, unwanted, entirely cut off from family. The tiny bit of rice that prisoners received might have sand or glass in it. They would plant or forage for vegetables to supplement their diets. When working the fields, prisoners were often forbidden from using sickles because it was one half of the now-banned communist logo. On Bali, one group of prisoners would carefully collect and utilize their own feces to fertilize tiny bits of soil and grow vegetables. They would pass the time by singing songs, either those from the days of Sukarno or based on their own experiences. The refrain to one of them, sung in Spanish, came from the title of Fidel Castro's 1953 speech, La Historia Me Absolverá, History Will Absolve Me. It was also in 1975 that the withdrawal of another colonial power sent ripples throughout the Third World. The dictatorship in Portugal, which had ruled since 1933, had fallen apart. The United States developed a contingency plan to invade parts of Portuguese territory if a government it considered communist took over. Lucky for the Portuguese, Washington allowed the elected left-wing, not communist, government to exist. The new Portuguese administration decided on a rapid withdrawal from what was left of its empire. Suharto looked east, and he pulled out his old bag of tricks. Among Portugal's newly freed colonies was the small nation of East Timor, which shared an island with Indonesian territory. When East Timor gained its independence, Suharto claimed he was threatened by communism on his borders. Calling this a wild exaggeration would be generous. Neither China, the Soviet Union, nor Vietnam was backing the tiny country. The party that oversaw the Timorese Declaration of Independence, Fretilin, did have a left wing, and some of its members used Marxist language, which was hardly surprising for a Portuguese-speaking national liberation movement at the time. But this was enough for Washington, which was convinced that East Timor could become a Cuba in Asia, even though Nixon had already re-established relations with the Communist Party in Beijing. He gave Suharto a big wink, and the Indonesian generals quickly drew up Operasi Seroja, Operation Lotus. Indonesia invaded in December 1975. The people of East Timor did not want the Indonesian military there. Fretilin radicalized and launched a people's war against the invaders. To put down the freedom fighters, the Indonesian armed forces killed up to 300,000 people. From 1975 to 1979, while both Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter sat in the White House, Washington's closest ally in Southeast Asia annihilated up to a third of the population of East Timor, a higher percentage than those who died under Pol Pot in Cambodia. In former Portuguese colonies in Africa, a different type of bloodshed emerged. In both Mozambique and Angola, full-on Cold War conflicts broke out, with the participation of the world's greater and lesser powers on both sides. Still under Brezhnev, the Soviet Union had begun to intervene more forcefully in the Third World, believing temporarily and incorrectly that the United States would grant the Soviets freedom to intervene, just as they had allowed Washington to meddle with Chile in 1973. The United States did not. Washington backed proxies in both countries who fought alongside Zaire, as Mobutu's Congo was called at the time, apartheid South Africa, and Rhodesia, all joined together against Moscow's favored movements. Cuba sent 25,000 troops to Angola to assist Moscow's ally. A small number of American and British volunteers, often single, unemployed men responding to magazine classified ads, enlisted to join white supremacist forces in Rhodesia and South Africa. Back in formerly Portuguese South America, there was an internal split within Brazil's dictatorship. Medici was no longer in power, and the new top general, Ernesto Geisel, favored a relaxation of counterinsurgency measures and a so-called abertura, or slow opening, of Brazilian society. The problem was that torture and murder, as they often do, had created powerful elements within the state whose privileges derived from the existence of endless war. They opposed the abertura and favored expanding the violence to include unsuspecting, law-abiding members of the Communist Party. It is believed that Brazil's own Operação Jakarta, or Jakarta Operation, was a plan that aimed to intensify, rather than moderate, repression, and therefore derail abertura. It is also believed that a beloved journalist named Vladimir Herzog was one of its few victims. Herzog was a popular middle-class newsman who operated very openly. Though no big fan of the USSR, he had been inspired by Alexander Dubček's Socialism with a Human Face in Czechoslovakia, he joined the Brazilian Communist Party in the early 1970s. The PCB was pursuing a moderate path, building a united democratic front, and was one of the most organized groups opposing the dictatorship, along with parts of the Catholic Church. In October 1975, Herzog became editor-in-chief of the public station TV Cultura. A right-wing journalist called the station TV Viet Cultura because of his communist infiltration. On October 25, 1975, Herzog was called for questioning by the Brazilian army. He went into the military offices voluntarily. He did not come out. No one bought the official version of the story, that he had killed himself. A grisly photo of his body, slung too close to the ground for hanging to be effective, made the dictatorship's claims even more patently offensive, and his death galvanized the nation into protest. Influential members of the Catholic Church hierarchy took up the cause of Herzog's death and trained increasingly harsh critiques on the military regime. Instead of escalating Brazil's internal war, the Jakarta operation had backfired and forced the military to back off. Despite the wishes of some hardline elements, Geisel's abertura continued. Brazil started to slide little by little away from its more hardline anti-communist neighbors. Meanwhile, Chile's Operation Condor continued to expand its activities all around South America until the continent was a veritable anti-communist killing zone. Thereafter, any real threat to U.S.-aligned authoritarian capitalist development existed mostly in the paranoid minds of the Condor Alliance dictators and their U.S. allies. The fanatical anti-communists won the continent. In 1976, a coup in Argentina brought to power the bloodiest of these regimes. Under General Jorge Rafael Videla, the dictatorship kidnapped, tortured, and disappeared tens of thousands of people. Videla's regime cast a much wider net than Pinochet's men did. This period is often called, somewhat incorrectly, the Dirty War, but there was no war. It was a top-down, anti-communist extermination campaign with ideological roots in Argentina's homegrown fascist movement. Subversives were tortured and killed for their real or perceived communism, for their real or perceived atheism, for their real or perceived Jewishness, or just for union activities. Ford Motor Company and Citibank collaborated with the disappearance of union workers. Even beards were suspect. That's why a Brazilian piano player named Tenorino was brought in, thrown on a parrilla, or grill, for torture in Buenos Aires, and then drowned. Representatives from Argentina's military had already been at the meeting that launched Operation Condor in 1975, and the murderous AAA alliance, the Alianza Anticomunista Argentina, had begun unleashing terror under Isabel Martinez de Perón, who served as president from 1974 to 1976. But the true believers were now in power. Admiral Emilio Massera declared Argentina was fighting a third world war between dialectic materialism and idealistic humanism. This meant removing the influence of Marx, as well as Freud and Albert Einstein. General Antonio Domingo explained how this worked. First, we will kill all subversives, then we will kill all of their collaborators, then those who sympathize with subversives, then we will kill those that remain indifferent, and finally, we kill the timid. But the Condor Alliance didn't limit their activities to their own continent. They built upon the stay-behind armies Frank Wisner had helped to build in Europe to pursue their enemies in Germany, Spain, Italy, and Ireland. The men behind Operation Condor often considered the nonviolent democracy and human rights activists operating abroad to be even more dangerous than armed guerrillas at home. Most infamously, this logic led U.S. citizen, known CIA contact, and Condor operative Michael Townley to murder former Chilean Foreign Minister Orlando Letelier in the heart of Washington, D.C. A car bomb placed on Embassy Row blew Letelier's legs off, killing him instantly. His 25-year-old American assistant, Ronnie Moffitt, staggered from the car and slowly drowned in her own blood. Townley is now in FBI witness protection. In 1978, Ng Gyok Tan was admitted to the University of Sao Paulo, USP. This was a huge accomplishment for an immigrant from a poor Asian country. She would be studying, free, at the best college in Brazil, only 15 years after she and her family shoved off from Jakarta on that rusty old hospital ship. But for her hardworking family, this seemed natural. She worked like hell at her good, almost entirely white high school, and her parents put their heads down too, avoiding political conflict like the plague that it had been for their whole lives. It also felt natural as she drifted toward the left-leaning counterculture at USP. Brazilian universities at the time, especially the elite institutions, were hotbeds of student activism. This wasn't the staid, ultra-disciplined communist organization of the 1950s and 60s. This was a much more eclectic group of kids. This was the era of Tropicália, global rock and roll devoured and reconstituted as a mix of Brazilian high art concept and savage indigenous pride, cultural liberation, and more than anything else, opposition to the censorship imposed by the dictatorship. Ng Gyok also realized, very quickly, that there were no black students in her class at USP either. It was in this milieu that Ng, as everyone called her now, met her Uruguayan friend Hernan Pietro Schmidt, or Tupa, as they called him. He was always terrified of the police for reasons she didn't quite understand. He wasn't even a particularly active or left-wing student, but when he told her, it all made sense, as did his nickname. His father had been a Tupamaro, a member of the Uruguayan left-wing group that had prompted Brazil to threaten invading the neighboring country in 1971. Under the dictatorship that consolidated power in Uruguay starting in 1973, the new anti-communist regime sent men into Hernan's home and took his father away. She didn't know it, but this was the fourth time that Washington's violent anti-communist campaign had affected her life personally. First, the U.S.-backed military, the nascent state within a state, had ignited anti-Chinese riots in her part of Indonesia, forcing her family to flee the country. Second, her family lived through Brazil's U.S.-backed military coup in 1964. Third, the mass murder in Indonesia demolished life for the relatives who had stayed home, and now one of her college buddies was the victim of an Operation Condor campaign. That same year, 1978, alarm bells began to ring far north of Sao Paulo. A new wave of guerrilla movements seemed to threaten the fragile military oligarchies that had been established by Frank Wisner and the CIA back in the 1950s. So, with the help of Washington, some of South America's most messianic anti-communists turned their attention north. Essentially, Operation Condor was extended to Central America. Drain the sea. The countries of Central America are far more united than the nations of South America. Its peoples know one another well, and they tend to experience the waves of history in a similar fashion. This is especially true of the four most populous countries in the middle: Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Honduras. Belize, at the very top, was a British colony, and down at the bottom, Panama took a very different historical path after the U.S. created the nation in order to build a canal. And world history had crashed over their little subcontinent with punishing violence over the past few centuries. In the late 1970s and 80s, this process rose to astonishing levels of brutality. Before this new storm of blood and screams even started, brutal oppression was already the rule for the vast majority of the population. The region was ruled by dictators who rarely bothered to hide their cruelty. The practice of forced labor, that is, the enslavement of the indigenous peoples that had started centuries prior, was still widespread. In Guatemala, the terror that started in 1954 and accelerated in 1965 after the arrival of John Gordon Mine and John P. Longan had never stopped. The year those two men arrived, 1965, El Salvador, Costa Rica, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Panama came together to formalize military links and intelligence sharing within El Consejo de Defensa Centroamericana, CONDECA, a kind of proto-alliance to put down the guerrilla threat. That threat was real. Mine himself was killed in 1968 by the FAR, the first rebel group formed in Guatemala in the wake of the 1960 clash over the CIA's use of a Guatemalan base to train Cuban exiles for the Bay of Pigs invasion. The violence unleashed by the Guatemalan dictatorship during the civil war that followed was indiscriminate. Right-wing terror groups like La Mano Blanca, the White Hand, the New Anti-Communist Organization, and the Anti-Communist Council of Guatemala started their own massacres with the support of U.S. Green Berets, and these death squads were eventually incorporated into the state. The disappearances that started in 1966 had expanded by the 1970s to transform Guatemala's cities into hunting grounds for any kind of perceived leftist or subversive. The number of people desaparecido by the state rose into the tens of thousands. If you were a union member, a student activist, a left-leaning politician, a critical journalist, or even a homeless child, you knew that the regime might come for you. As tension periodically rose around you, friends disappeared forever, you escalated evasive tactics, then settled back into your normal life of low-level terror if you survived this time. Life was a permanent cat-and-mouse game, and Guatemala City became a deadly, sprawling obstacle course, sometimes for the entire lifespan of its victims. Miguel Angel Albizures, the same little schoolboy who never forgot the trauma of the Sulfatos bombs dropped near his school during the U.S.-backed coup in 1954, grew into a union organizer. The unions were not uniformly left-wing. As a teen, not long after the overthrow of Arbenz, he joined the Catholic Christian Workers Movement, and by the 1970s, he was a bit of a small-time leader. The union movement had moderate communists and Christian Democrats, as well as some who supported the more radical guerrillas. The government did not care much for these distinctions. In 1977, they busted open the door of a union meeting Miguel was attending, firing their guns. Miguel fled onto the roof and jumped from building to escape. Another time, they shot down several of his colleagues in front of the Coca-Cola factory. He knew he was lucky in a way, because they apparently didn't want to simply kill him. They easily could have done that in the street, with some men in a car with machine guns. They wanted to capture, torture, and disappear him, hopefully getting some information along the way and creating mystery around his death. Since that was a little harder to pull off, he kept bobbing and weaving until he found a way out of the country. We could never sleep in the same place for too long. We didn't see our families. It was constant suspicion, unending fear. We didn't know what was going on, but we knew that bodies were appearing everywhere around us, so we knew enough. By 1978, things were changing for Central America. In Nicaragua, a left-wing guerrilla group inspired by the Cuban Revolution, the Sandinistas, was poised to win power. In El Salvador, the government responded to protests against an obviously rigged election with a massacre. Hundreds were killed. Then a coup there led to a civil-military regime, which also devolved into murderous repression, leading the civilians to quit, and support grew for leftist guerrillas. All this made Guatemala's government nervous about its own survival. At home, new guerrilla groups were taking over for the older MR-13 and FAR, which had been crushed by the U.S.-backed insurgency campaign. The most prominent new group was the Ejército Guerrero de los Pobres, EGP, or the Guerrilla Army of the Poor. Unlike the FAR, which followed Che Guevara's FOCO, focus strategy, of organizing small guerrilla units, the EGP sought to enlist the larger rural population in the guerrilla struggle, emulating the victorious Viet Cong. The Guatemalan government began to kill indigenous people en masse simply because of their ethnic background. Entire ethnicities, whole tribes, complete villages were marked as either communist or liable to become communist. They were often people who had only a vague idea of what Marxism or the guerrilla groups were. This was new, different from the urban terror tactics, in which government forces kidnapped individual people. For the Mayans and other indigenous groups, the army would come and simply kill every single one of them. The close collaboration of U.S. officials with Central American dictatorships as they slaughtered their own populations is well documented, far better than U.S. activities in Indonesia leading up to October 1965. The scale of the violence, however, and the consequences of the actions are often underestimated. Miguel Ángel Albizures and others who lived through the late 1970s and 80s in Central America always stress that these new Central American guerrilla movements emerged after attempts at peaceful transition to democracy were brutally suppressed, or indeed exterminated. They say that almost every political ideology in the world, not just the socialism and Marxism dominant in those guerrilla groups, allows for armed resistance against tyrants, and that includes the U.S. revolutionary tradition. Nor is it surprising that the surviving movements were left-wing militants. By the late 70s, most of the moderate dissidents were dead. In January 1979, the Khmer Rouge fell, and the world found out what had been happening in Cambodia. The government, if it can be called that, fell because the Vietnamese communists realized what Pol Pot had been doing, and also because he bafflingly attacked his more powerful former allies. Vietnam invaded and easily toppled the secretive, psychotic cabal that had been terrorizing the country since 1975. The Khmer Rouge were driven into the forests and mountains along the Thai border. Vietnam took over most of the country, closed down the killing fields, and allowed Cambodians to return to the cities under a government of their own creation. Around a quarter of Cambodians were dead. The United States did not celebrate the fall of the murderous Khmer Rouge. China, which had been moving closer to Washington since Nixon's visit in 1973, was allied with Pol Pot. Deng Xiaoping was furious and unwilling to tolerate what he perceived as Vietnam's aggression against China's ally. He resolved to invade Vietnam and told the U.S. about the plan. President Carter said he could not openly condone an attack, but assured Deng he understood that China cannot allow Vietnam to pursue aggression with impunity, and he privately promised to support Beijing if the Soviets threatened to assist the Vietnamese. The Chinese invasion of Vietnam in 1979 is often forgotten for two reasons. First, it complicates narratives about the putative international communist conspiracy, or at least the supposedly monolithic Asian communist movement. According to uninformed Western thinking, China and Vietnam were supposed to be on the same side. But more importantly, the episode has been forgotten because the Vietnamese immediately defeated and humiliated the Chinese People's Liberation Army. After decades of battle with France and the U.S., the Vietnamese were too good for the nation that had once ruled them for more than 1,000 years. Clashes with China in the second half of the 1970s also led to the worst human rights violations under the new communist regime in United Vietnam. Partly as a way to undermine the power of ethnic Chinese in Vietnam, seen as potentially disloyal, Hanoi announced the nationalization of all private businesses. Hundreds of thousands of refugees set off, including the so-called boat people, penniless and looking for a new life, and tens of thousands died. At the time, Benny was in Thailand. He had finished his stint in Chile and returned to Bangkok with the UN. Not long after he arrived, a colleague of his, a young Australian, came back from the Cambodian-Thai border with wild tales. There were Cambodians stumbling out of the jungle, starving and collapsing on Thai soil, he said. After the fall of the Khmer Rouge, they were fleeing to whomever might help them. Benny went to see for himself. At the border, he broke down in tears. He saw refugees in rags fleeing the country by the tens of thousands, often emaciated and barely able to walk, seemingly unable to speak or smile, and immediately sent a cable to New York. "Please send me to Cambodia." He was sent to New York instead, where he had to witness something just as shocking. The United States chose to recognize the remnants of the Khmer Rouge at the United Nations, keeping its tiny regime alive and refusing to recognize the Vietnamese allied government. This would last for years. Partly it was a way to appease Carter's new ally in Beijing, but Benny knew that it was something else too. They hated Vietnam too much, Benny said. They couldn't forgive them for winning the war. Much to his chagrin, ASEAN, the organization of Southeast Asian states that Indonesia had helped found in 1967, backed the Khmer Rouge too. In Central America, however, Jimmy Carter's government tapped the brakes a bit on brutal realpolitik. In this era, after both Watergate and the 1975 Church Committee investigations into the CIA and FBI, the U.S. media were less reflexively uncritical of Washington's covert and overt Cold War schemes abroad. Outlets such as the New York Times and Washington Post played crucial roles in publicizing the massacre at Penzos, Guatemala, the village where the military was caught gunning down men, women, and children in 1978. Washington banned the sale of weapons to regimes that did not meet basic human rights criteria. Rather than even try, the Guatemalan dictatorship, now run by a man named Fernando Romeo Lucas Garcia, turned to Israel and Taiwan, which stepped in to supply the weapons and assistance instead. U.S.-Guatemala collaboration continued at a number of levels, but Carter's position was enough to enrage some of the most committed anti-communists in the hemisphere. Mario Sandoval Alarcón, one of the founders of La Mano Blanca and now vice president, accused the Carter administration's Inter-American Commission on Human Rights of being a Marxist instrument that has used the cause of human rights as a tool for slander. In July 1979, the Sandinistas took Managua and set up a government in Nicaragua. For leftists across Central America, this was a moment of effervescence, just as 1970 had been for Chilean socialists. The Sandinistas had not only won, they had gotten away with it. Even The Clash, the punk band over in England, sang ecstatically about the shocking development. For the first time ever, when they had a revolution in Nicaragua, there was no interference from America. Human rights in America, the people fought the leader and up he flew, with no Washington bullets, what else could he do? In its early days, the Communist Party in Nicaragua had opposed the Sandinistas' emphasis on armed struggle. Over the years, the Frente Sandinista de Liberación Nacional, FSLN, split into three factions. The group that won out, the relatively moderate third faction known as the Terceristas, favored a broad tactical alliance with the bourgeoisie. It was this group, led by Daniel and Humberto Ortega, that took power as the dominant part of a coalition government. The Terceristas would stand in democratic elections. Like Ho Chi Minh, Mao, Arbenz, Fidel, Sukarno, and Allende before them, the Terceristas initially hoped to set up a government that Washington could tolerate. Infamously, these hopes would be dashed when Reagan took over and began funding the Contra rebels. But the leaders of Operation Condor did not wait for a go-ahead from Reagan to handle the leftist government taking root in Central America. In 1977, convinced that Carter had abandoned them in their holy war on communism, Argentine officials began providing military training to the Somoza regime in Nicaragua. After the 1979 Sandinista victory, they set up a base in Honduras to teach Guatemalans and Nicaraguans the art of counter-revolution and repression. Central American soldiers went to Chile for training in anti-communist counterinsurgency tactics. The 1980 meeting of the Latin American chapter of the World Anti-Communist League, held in Buenos Aires, enabled Death Squad leaders to form even closer ties with South American governments, as well as U.S. Republican congressmen. The methods that were used in Central America in the following years reflected the defining features of Operation Condor: targeted abductions and murders by multinational hunter-killer squadrons, often made up of Contras and Honduran commandos in civilian clothes, clandestine transfers of prisoners across borders, methods like disappearance, torture, and assassination of victims, including the use of electric shock, the capucha, asphyxiation, and the throwing of live people from helicopters, interrogations of prisoners by officers from several countries, and detention centers for foreign disappeared prisoners. When Reagan took over, Washington returned to more open and aggressive anti-communist tactics than had been seen in two decades. The CIA eagerly joined the Argentines in Honduras, and, in the biggest agency operation since the Bay of Pigs, began training and funding the Contra rebels. The Contras were not a regular army and never seriously tried to best the Sandinistas in a direct confrontation. They were a well-funded terrorist group seeking to destabilize the regime however they could, and their worldview and tactics were radically transformed by the fanatical anti-communism of their sponsors. The former public relations chief of the Contras, Edgar Chamorro, made clear that the powerful ideological influence of the Argentine officers and CIA operations reshaped their movement. Historian Patrice McSherry writes that the anti-Sandinistas were originally concerned with retaining their private property and oligarchical power and privilege, or pursuing revenge. But the messianic anti-communist ideology of the Argentines and the Americans began to reshape their rationale for the war. They also learned lessons from abroad. A CIA officer going by John Kirkpatrick, with counterinsurgency experience in the Phoenix program in Vietnam, compiled a training course that included an assassination manual for the Contras. One section was titled Implicit and Explicit Terror. According to Argentine journalists Juan Pablo Sipka and Ignacio González Janzen, the Argentines and the Central Americans had also discussed employing the Jakarta method. They report that in the early 1970s, before the country had fallen to brutal dictator Videla, the leader of Argentina's far-right AAA death squad, a politician named José López Rega was in Franco's Spain. There he met with Máximo Zepeda, the leader of Guatemala's new anti-communist organization Death Squad. They spoke of the Plan Yakarta and what it entailed, a prophylactic coup that would allow them to defeat the Marxists by virtually exterminating them after conservatives took power. These Argentine authors claimed the meeting was arranged by the U.S. ambassador to Spain, Robert Hill, and that frequent CIA collaborator Zepeda not only handed over some Plan Yakarta reports he held, but told his anti-communist comrade that Washington could assist him in forming shock troops to put the plan into action in Argentina. "We won't need to kill a million like in Indonesia," López Rega reportedly said, "because we can get it done with 10,000. He guessed low. Anti-communists killed far more than that in Argentina. On March 24, 1980, Catholic Archbishop Oscar Romero began to say Mass in San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador. Romero had recently spoken out against the wanton human rights abuses committed by the government. After he finished his sermon that night, a man burst into the church and murdered him. The assassination was carried out by a death squad led by Major Roberto Dabuisson, a fanatical anti-communist who had trained at the School of the Americas in 1972. Whereas Fort Leavenworth is an all-purpose military academy for students from all over the world, the School of the Americas, based in the U.S.-controlled Panama Canal Zone, was a training ground for Latin American counterinsurgents. The school became so notorious that Panama expelled it from its territory, and the school changed its name in 2000 to the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. Dabuisson also attended the Political Warfare Cadres Academy in Taiwan, which by then had provided training to officials from almost every Latin American nation. In 1983, Dabuisson summed up the actually existing anti-communist ideology very well. "You can be a communist," he told reporter Lori Beckland, even if you personally don't believe you are a communist. When the Salvadoran Civil War got underway, the military, backed by Ronald Reagan, made scorched earth tactics a routine part of its modus operandi. On December 11, 1981, reports surfaced of a massacre at El Mozote village. Salvadoran troops executed more than 900 men, women, and children with U.S.-made assault rifles. The next day, Reagan appointed a Harvard-trained former liberal named Elliot Abrams to serve as Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights and Humanitarian Affairs. Put simply, his job was to defend U.S.-allied right-wing regimes to the press and shield them from criticism coming from appalled human rights groups. Abrams called the accounts of the slaughter in El Mozote, including those published in the New York Times, communist propaganda. This is still the most famous atrocity of the Salvadoran Civil War, but it was only a tiny fraction of the violence unleashed on civilians. For years and years, the savagery dragged on and only deepened because Washington refused to allow the right-wing government to negotiate a political solution with the rebels. Since the rebels had links to communists in Nicaragua, no negotiation was possible, according to Reagan's logic. But it was in Guatemala, Central America's biggest country, and the site of the CIA's first major victory in the hemisphere back in 1954, that normal people faced the largest bloodbath unleashed by the Cold War in the Western Hemisphere. The small community of Ilom is nestled between misty mountains in northwest Guatemala, closer to the Mexican border than to the capital. The people are Mayan and speak Ixil, not Spanish, and for decades they had been either subsistence farming or working for pennies on a nearby ranch. That ranch was owned by rich white men and sat on the land taken from the Mayans centuries ago, and over the years it kept getting bigger and bigger. Ilom is too far from Guatemala City to have been affected by Jacobo Arbenz's incipient land reform program in 1954. Residents barely heard about the reforms that were snuffed out by the CIA. In 1981, however, global politics arrived in the village. First, the EGP, the Ejército Guerrero de los Pobres, came to visit. Speaking Spanish, the guerrillas explained that they were on the Mayan side, that they were building a revolution that would help them get their land back, and they were fighting for them. Josefa Sanchez del Barrio, who was 16 at the time, remembers that most of the villagers were politely receptive to this message, if a bit puzzled about the specifics. Few of them spoke Spanish. It wasn't quite clear what these 30 to 40 revolutionaries in green fatigues planned to do, or how the villagers were supposed to help them, but the villagers thanked them, gave them the customary hospitality of thick corn tortillas and some kind words, and waved goodbye. Not long after, the army sent in men pretending to be guerrillas. It didn't take long for the villagers to figure out what was going on. The men's costumes were shoddy, one even wore a cheap fake beard, and they were acting all wrong, asking too many questions and treating the villagers aggressively. The guerrillas hadn't acted that way at all when they came. This was not a sophisticated undercover operation. They were clearly just some young military men trying to figure out who was most sympathetic to the rebels. In January 1982, the military men came back. This time, they were in their army uniforms, but with black paint on their faces. They burst into Josefa's home. It didn't surprise her that her family was on their list. Her father had been part of a small group that tried, back in the 70s, to ask the local government down in the nearest city to save their land. They dragged away her husband's father. They smashed Josefa in the head with a rock. Then several men shoved a napkin into her mouth and raped her. All in all, 30 people were taken that day, never to return. A few days later, the soldiers came back and took Josefa's father and brother. In February, the soldiers came again. Josefa's other brother was working in the field, and they lobbed a grenade at him and killed him. They took more people away that day, and this time they burned down the empty houses as they left. Antonio Cabacaba, a young boy, realized something was wrong that day when he came back from working in the fields. As he approached his home, he saw his mother standing in the doorway, wearing the long red skirt worn by Mayan women in the region, staring blankly into the distance. "What's wrong?" he asked her. She told him about the fires. The soldiers had burned an old woman alive in her home as they left. Some people began to discuss running, but there was nowhere to go except into the mountains, where they'd soon run out of food. This was the worst violence their community had ever experienced. They came to the conclusion that finally it must be over. They were wrong. On March 23rd, the soldiers came back at 5 in the morning and woke up every single person in Ilom. They were wearing black paint again. "Come on, there is a town meeting. You are going," they told Antonio and Josefa and everyone else. They walked the villagers to the tiny town square. They sent the men into the little church behind the plaza and the women into the tiny courthouse next door. Antonio heard one of them fidgeting on the radio, talking to a superior. "We're gonna kill the guerrillas," he said. One by one, then two by two, they brought men out of the church, stood them in front of the schoolhouse, and shot them. Everyone could see each murder. That was clearly the point. After about 100 were dead, they stopped. "We're only killing the ones that look guilty, the ones that look afraid," one of the soldiers said. Other villages weren't so lucky. In many parts of this region, the military simply killed every man, woman, and child. The government had decided that the Ixil were intrinsically communist, or at least very likely to become communist. In Indonesia, it may not have been the case that the mass murder was genocide. It was simply anti-communist mass murder. In Guatemala, it was anti-communist genocide. On March 23, 1982, General Efrén Ríos Montt took power in Guatemala in a military coup. He was an evangelical Christian, which made him a special favorite of Ronald Reagan, and continued the genocide in a slightly different fashion. Some indigenous people from ethnically suspect communities were herded into state-built aldeas modelos, model villages, built to help indigenous people start new lives in suitably non-communist fashion, which often amounted to little more than deadly concentration camps. For many others, the massacres simply continued apace. As was the case in Indonesia and Brazil and Argentina, Montt's religious zeal gave the anti-communist violence a theological justification. "They are communists and therefore atheists, and therefore they are demons, and therefore you can kill them," is how one Civil War victim, now the head of one of Guatemala's most prominent research organizations, summarizes the logic. The vast majority of the murdered were practitioners of traditional Mayan religions. The remaining residents of Ilom were forced into slavery, but this time they had to work for the military. Antonio was forced to join a militia and grew up fighting the guerrillas for the rest of the 1980s. They rebelled quietly by intentionally missing when shooting at the enemy. Josefa quickly married. If she had not, she would have been forced to marry one of the soldiers watching over the Aldea Modelo, forced into sexual slavery like so many of her friends. Their village was liquidated and burned to the ground. This was all part of Ríos Montt's new strategy for fighting communism. "The guerrilla is the fish, the people are the sea," he said. "If you cannot catch the fish, you have to drain the sea." From 1978 to 1983, the Guatemalan military killed more than 200,000 people. Around a third of these were taken away and disappeared, largely in urban areas. Most of the rest were indigenous Mayans massacred in the open air of the fields and mountains where their families had lived for generations. The Salvadoran Civil War took 75,000 lives. Again, the majority were innocent people killed by the government. Argentina killed 20,000 to 30,000 civilians, and other Operation Condor nations killed tens of thousands more. Anti-communist extermination had spread all across Latin America, always with the assistance of the United States. Taken together, the death toll approaches the estimated size of the 1965 to 66 massacres in Indonesia. Even the anti-communists' great enemy, the supposed reason for all this terror, did not deploy this kind of violence. Using numbers compiled by the U.S.-funded Freedom House organization, historian John Coatsworth concluded that from 1960 to 1990, the number of victims of U.S.-backed violence in Latin America vastly exceeded the number of people killed in the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc over the same period of time. The Fall. The violence in Central America raged on until the fall of the Berlin Wall, and then kept going. From 1989 to 1991, the Soviet Union fell apart spectacularly, along with all the states that Moscow directly established in the wake of World War II. The Second World was no more, and its residents experienced this as the literal collapse of their governments. For the rest of the planet, most of which had somehow been affected by the Cold War, some things changed and some things did not. In the First World, North Americans and Western Europeans watched triumphantly. Leaders in the West felt vindicated by very persuasive evidence that Soviet communism was not a sustainable system. In parts of the Third World, most specifically the regions where the Cold War was still being fought, there was some relief. Benny was able finally to triumph at the UN. He had been lobbying for years to get the US to stop recognizing the Khmer Rouge as Cambodia's official government and trying to tell the world about the horrors inflicted by Pol Pot. Benny was influential in getting enough countries on board to end the diplomatic impasse caused by Washington's stubborn opposition to Hanoi. In 1992, he moved to Siem Reap, the most chaotic part of the country, to try to help put together a new UN-coordinated coalition government. In El Salvador, a truce was finally allowed. In 1992, the FMLN rebels simply became a legal party. Historians suspect that probably could have happened long before if fanatical anti-communism had not led Washington to block any possibility of negotiations. In Nicaragua, the Sandinistas easily won the 1984 election. Washington told the right-wing opposition not to participate since the Reagan administration did not want the vote to appear legitimate. The Contras never stopped their terrorism. It was clear to everyone, as the country went to the polls again in 1990, that the violence would not stop until the leftists lost power. The Nicaraguan people voted them out, and they left peacefully. In Afghanistan, where Soviet troops had been trying to prop up a communist ally for 9 years, Moscow's forces retreated, the CIA-backed Islamist fundamentalists set up a fanatical theocracy, and the West stopped paying attention. In Chile, Pinochet had been removed from power by national plebiscite in 1988, but he remained army commander-in-chief until 1998, when he became a senator for life. For the two biggest anti-communist governments ever set up in the former Third World, the end of the Cold War had an indirect effect. Both Indonesia and Brazil transitioned from authoritarian rule to multi-party democracy. They did so at different times. Brazil started the process well before the fall of the Berlin Wall, and Suharto left power almost a decade after it fell. Crucially, however, they both did it the same way. In Brazil and Indonesia, the transition from military dictatorship was carried out in a controlled manner. Negotiated transfers of power both maintained the fundamental social structure the dictatorships were set up to protect and provided impunity for the rulers, who remained wealthy and influential. The elites who felt threatened by social movements in the 1950s and 60s remained in charge, and the countries were well integrated into the global capitalist system. This was now the case in almost every country in Latin America and the vast majority of Southeast Asia. In different ways and to varying degrees, fanatical anti-communism remained a powerful force in both countries and in the surrounding regions. It took different form, both overt and latent, but it was there, always threatening to reanimate. It certainly did not leave the earth when the putative Soviet threat disappeared. Nor did Washington change its stance toward Cuba after the fall of the Soviet Union. Instead of moderating pressure on Havana or trying a different tactic, Washington tightened the screws, passing the Helms-Burton Act in 1992 and penalizing all companies doing business with Cuba. But Cuba remained resilient. Castro buckled down, and the island made it through a so-called special period, marked by deprivation worse than it had seen since the 1950s, by reintroducing capitalism and relying on tourism. It's hard to explain U.S. behavior toward Cuba as a response to the fear of Soviet communism or as a defense of freedom. From 1960 to the present, Cuba was very far from the most repressive political system or the worst violator of human rights in the hemisphere. Perhaps Castro had committed the unforgivable sin of very publicly surviving repeated coup and assassination attempts in a way that embarrassed Washington. Or perhaps the real threat Washington perceived was the possibility of a rival model outside the global American-led system, the same thing that we now know bothered U.S. officials about Guatemala in 1954, Bandung in 1955, and Chile in 1973. There's another thing the U.S. certainly didn't change. Immediately after the end of the Cold War, U.S. officials, especially President George H.W. Bush, had talked about a peace dividend. The idea was that, with Soviet communism gone, Washington would cut back on military spending and violent foreign engagements. The exact opposite happened. There was a small decrease in spending in the 90s, and then the Pentagon budget exploded again after the turn of the century. Barack Obama ran as an anti-war candidate, yet when he finished his term in 2016, the United States was actively bombing at least 7 countries. The past 2 decades have led the best historians to take a wider view of U.S. behavior. Before and after the Cold War, the United States was always an expansionist and aggressive power. In an historical sense, and especially as seen from the South, the Cold War was a continuation of colonialism through slightly different means, writes Odd Arn Westad. The new and rampant interventionism we have seen after the Islamist attacks on America in September 2001 is not an aberration, but a continuation, in a slightly more extreme form, of U.S. policy during the Cold War. In Africa, the civil wars ended in different ways, but crony capitalism and resource extraction became the rule almost everywhere. In Eastern Europe, the collapse of communism was not as clean a process as the West often believed. Nuri, the daughter of Sukarno's ambassador to Cuba, had moved to Bulgaria with her Bulgarian husband after she left Fidel's care in Havana. In 1990, Bulgaria held an election. Despite Washington's generous support for the opposition, the Bulgarian Socialist Party, the new name for the communists, won. But U.S. and European officials made it clear they were unwilling to deal with the socialists, and after a period of strife and protest, the socialists handed power to a coalition government. Over the next few years, living standards dropped precipitously. Nuri and her husband, who had been used to high employment and decent public services at least, if not democratic freedoms, watched in horror as the economy shrank for 9 years in a row and inflation spiraled out of control. "When I finally got to go back to Indonesia, it was shocking to hear what people think communism is," Nuri said. "I lived through it, and they are just wrong. And living in Bulgaria under communism was a hell of a lot better than living in Suharto's Indonesia." In Guatemala, the civil war ended in 1996. The surviving people of Ilom were finally able to return home and reconstruct their tiny village. The only way to get there now, if you don't have a car, is to climb windy, dangerous roads on a crowded, recycled school bus from the United States. The journey takes 2 to 3 days from Guatemala City, about 80 miles away. The Mayans still wear the red skirts that Antonio's mother was wearing the day she realized her neighbor had been burned alive. Villagers still farm corn, wake up early, and take horses through the trees to work the fields, and come home at sunset to sit and tell stories in Ixil and laugh. But to participate in the modern economy that has grown up around them, they also need money. For that, they send their teenage sons and daughters to the United States. Josefa's son went in 2016 when he was 17. Everyone knows that if you go before you turn 18, it's easier to get in the country and stay there. He has a construction job in Florida where he learned pretty good Spanish. Having paid back his coyote, the man who smuggled him across the border, he can send money home. Ilom keeps sending more of its youth up north. This is not about love for the United States or the American dream. They don't want to go. They know who was responsible for the violence they'd suffered. "A lot of us, just really a lot of us, have gone to the United States," said Antonio Cabacaba as he was showing me around Ilom. "We walked by the plaza where he watched almost every man he knew get murdered for being some kind of a suspected communist." He said, "I guess it's funny. Well, maybe funny isn't the word, but we know who is responsible for the violence that destroyed this place. We know it was the United States that was behind it, but we keep sending our kids there because they have nowhere else to go."